The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
This is Susie Pratt. The story is I Have Read the Terms of Use by Kenneth Schneier. As a condition of the use and enjoyment of the body selected for your use, you agree to the following terms of use. You understand that the aforementioned body is designed for no more than 70 years of operation, and that attempts to employ said body for any period beyond the aforementioned duration carries no guarantee that it will function in any capacity. You understand further that we have no control over the actions of other vendors, and that consequently the body selected for your use may be subject to the actions of other models not within our control, including infection, infestation, deformation, and decomposition before the expiration of the design period. You understand further that we have no control over the actions of other licensees, and that we are not responsible for the uses to which they put the bodies licensed to them, and that therefore we have no responsibility for murder, rape, mayhem, enslavement, oppression, or heartbreak thereby caused to the body selected for your use. You agree not to reverse engineer the body selected for your use or any of its components or subsystem. You agree that its ultimate design and origins will remain our proprietary trade secrets, and that you will make no efforts to discover the methods, materials, or first causes we employed in its development. You understand that any efforts on your part to discover, deduce, or decode the origins of this body will lead to false or misleading conclusions concerning our purposes and plans, and that we have no obligation to correct or otherwise respond to such conclusions. You understand that the body selected for your use is a component in a larger system, the species, which is itself a component in a larger system, the planet, which is itself a component in a larger system, the cosmos. You agree that the function of each component within its system and its interaction with other components in the system are our trade secrets and will not be disclosed to you at any time for any reason. You understand that we will not respond to any inquiries concerning those functions and interactions, and that any attempt by you to determine those functions or interactions will be a breach of these terms of use. You agree that you will be born into a race, class, gender, identity, sexuality, state of health, time, and place that will give you no ability to control the circumstances of your own life or affect any change for its improvement, and that whether you are valuable or valueless, skilled or unskilled, ugly or beautiful, will depend on the whims of licensees far away and utterly unknown to you. In the alternative, depending on the availability of various styles, colors, and options, you agree that you will be born into such privilege that you will have no awareness of the customs, preferences, tastes, joys, hopes, fears, or sorrows of any licensee not nearly identical to yourself, and that should you obtain information pertaining to your own acquiescence, responsibility, or culpability for, without limitation, the deprivations, pains, illnesses, dismemberment, torture, rape, or murder of licensees not nearly identical to yourself, you will treat such information as our intellectual property and none of your business, and will, to the extent practicable, understand such matters to be no fault of yours and contrary to your own good intentions. You understand that the body selected for your use is provided with a number of factory settings concerning the cultural norms under which it will operate, the starting conditions. You understand further that the starting conditions will be predetermined by existing relationships of power and wealth within the culture of which said body is a component. You agree that the starting conditions will determine your perceptions of morality and ethics, and that those perceptions will regard the existing power and wealth relationships of said culture to be appropriate, functional, and beneficial. You agree that you will not use the body selected for your use to infringe upon, alter, or amend any of the starting conditions, and that the distribution of goods, services, nutrition, medicine, affection, sexual gratification, and emotional support shall be substantially similar when you surrender the body selected for your use as when said body was initially provided. You agree to experience persistent confusion and disorientation concerning right action, wrong action, your obligation to your family, friends, community, nation, the species, the planet, and the cosmos, resulting in paralysis and inactivity concerning any matter of ethical or moral significance. In the alternative, depending on market conditions and supplies, you agree to experience irrational certainties and extreme passions concerning such matters, in which case you have sole responsibility for any resultant damage. You understand that we disclaim any representations or warranties other than those contained in these terms of use, and that no oral, psychological, historical, literary, or religious assurances you may have received from persons purporting to be our agents will be binding on us. You understand further that we expressly disclaim any implied warranties, including, without limitation, any implied warranty of survivability, likability, employability, health, sanity, or fitness for a particular purpose. You agree to hold us harmless from any direct, consequential, or incidental damages that may result from noncompliance with any assurances or implied warranties not contained in these terms of use. You agree that these terms of use shall be subject to such natural, moral, and spiritual laws as we have previously enacted, and that it is your responsibility to acquaint yourself with such laws. You agree that disputes concerning these terms of use shall be resolved by adjudicators of our choosing in a time and manner that seems best to us. You agree that we may alter these terms of use on one generation's notice to you. You may refuse such alterations by surrendering the body selected for your use at such time and place as we shall designate. Any use of this body, including but not limited to breathing, eating, drinking, sleeping, working, playing, loving, or hating, shall be deemed acceptance of these terms of use and shall be irrevocably binding upon you and your heirs, devisees, grantees, and assigns forever.
Hello, this is Lori Lee, and I will be reading Swarm, The Queen Commanded, by K.A. Gillette. Taja's seven fingers worked quickly, efficiently. The tiny brushes at the end of each digit distributed yellow pollen from flower to flower. She worked her way up the branch, pollinating, as directed by the chief of the ag station, every fifth flower. The tree limb, cool under the touch of her real hand, swayed as she shifted her weight to reach the farthest apple blossoms, those closest to the sky. Wide-based wooden ladders leaned against old, gnarled apple trunks as her team climbed into the trees beside hers. In most orchards, the trees were dwarf, with the horizontal branches low so that even a pollinator as short as Taja had no need to stand on tiptoes. But in this orchard, which stretched for kilometers to the horizon, the government was trying to preserve the old varieties, and some trees had branches six times her height. In the morning's quiet, Lavella in the next tree began to hum. Badal, his older brother, and then Taja joined in. Six more voices added depth and harmony. It was her team's way of greeting the day and making sure that everything was right. One missing voice, and someone in the group would check to see if anything was wrong. Here at the egg station in the far north, the season had just begun. Today they started pollinating the early-blooming Gravenstein and would finish with the northern spies. 2 months of labor, from beginning to end. 2 months at home, for the egg station was the place where she had been abandoned, the place where her body and those of her team had been transformed. They were the lucky children, the ones whose parents cared enough to travel north, away from the cities and the pollution, to leave their deformed children at a place where they could be enhanced. She had spent her early years roaming through these orchards, learning everything there was to know about apples and the other crops she would be called on to pollinate. It was here she met the children who became the members of her team, and it was here that she had met Jothan. "Taja," Badal called. "Is everything all right?" "I'm fine," she replied, realizing that she had stopped humming. "Just thinking." Lavella laughed. "She's thinking about Jothan. He's handsome enough to stop any song in its tracks." Taja's blush was lost behind the blossoms, but Lavella spoke the truth. During the last 10 months, while the team had traveled the pollination circuit, Jothan had become a man, in voice, in stature, and in maturity. He even had his own lab, or so he had told her last night when they met at dinner, and he said he had a surprise for her, just her. High in the tree, Taja glowed, wondering, excited. Usually, surprises were unpleasant and weather-related. Hail balls, fast-approaching thunderstorms, or violent windstorms. She peered through the branches suspiciously, but the cumulus clouds promised a day of fair weather. To avoid damaging the delicate pollen brushes, she retracted them into her fingers as her feet found the upper rungs of the ladder. She lowered herself carefully, using the trunk to keep herself stable, until she could safely grasp and climb down the ladder. Badal had already placed a ladder against the next tree for her. As Taja scrambled up the rungs, the voices in the trees around her exploded into a new melody, a love song meant to taunt. When Jothan grabbed Taja's real hand after dinner and pulled her away from her team, Badal hummed a few bars of the love song the team had sung earlier in the orchard. Taja's face grew warm, and she ducked her head, allowing her bangs to cover the flush of pleasure. She and Jothan walked hand in hand past a number of long, low, cement block buildings. Some had greenhouses on the roofs or attached to the sides. Some were dormitories, and others served as clinics where doctors and researchers worked on the perfection of the pollinator's extensions, like her own seven-fingered hand. Before the orchards began, an old and somewhat abandoned-looking building stood by itself off the road. Taja was somewhat curious about Jothan's choice. Why here, when the modern laboratories were back by the dormitories? He halted outside a door, painted a startling red. "Did you paint it?" she asked a little shyly. "Yes," he replied. "I had to get permission, but it wasn't too hard." Taja touched the door. They had talked of this color many times when they envisioned what the front door of their parents' homes might look like. This was the color Taja imagined. She grinned as he pressed his hand against the security pad and the door slid open. Inside, the room was small and rather noisy. Lab benches with black tops covered with an array of glassware and apparatus lined two walls, and two refrigerators and a deep freezer claimed most of the third. Three fresh white lab coats hung on hooks screwed into a door under a stenciled label reading Closet. "This is where I do my research," Jothan said, 9 to 7 every day. "Then I do a little of my own work." He led her to the closet door and brushed one of the coats to the side, revealing a row of old-fashioned locks. Jothan dropped her hand to pull a ring of keys from his pocket. "Top secret?" she joked. As the last lock clicked, he said, "You're the first to see what I've been working on. It's our secret until I figure out all the kinks. No one else is doing anything like this, at least not that I know." The door opened into another laboratory, even smaller than the first, which led to a greenhouse filled with potted trees in bloom. Taja breathed deeply and sighed. "The scent of apple blossoms never tires me." Something flew past her nose. Without thinking, she swatted the bug away and turned toward Jothun. "Are you breeding new varieties?" she asked, certain she had guessed the surprise. Maybe he had named one after her, a red one, the same color as the door. Or more likely, he had developed an entirely new fruit. For years they had argued about what would be the best fruit to eat, and they had compromised on a tart apple that grew in clusters like grapes, that you could pop in your mouth like a cherry, but had no seeds or core, just crisp, juicy, solid flesh. Had he managed to do it? He'd be famous. "No," he said, frowning, stooping to the floor to pick up the bug that she had swatted away. He set the bug in a small glass dish next to a large box on one of the lab benches that lined the two walls between the first lab and the greenhouse. "Didn't even try." He took her real hand again and said, "I did this for you, so we could be together, so you wouldn't have to leave the station for 10 months to pollinate, not unless you wanted to." "Not leave the station? Not leave Jothun?" With growing excitement, she said, "Tell me." "In a minute. There is one final step." He pulled a stool out from under one of the benches and motioned her to sit next to an old laptop. A picture of the two of them climbing trees when they were 6 was on the screen. She remembered the day well. He was trying out a new pair of legs, and they were only supposed to walk around the station. Jothun had insisted on climbing the tree, but they had climbed too high and both got stuck. "Taja?" "Sorry," she said, pointing to the screen. "I was remembering how they got us down from the tree with the ladder truck." He smiled and handed her a small black rectangle about the size of her pinky finger. "It's a microphone. I want you to say the words that flash onto the screen into the microphone. Don't laugh. No, you can't giggle either, or ask questions. Not yet." Taja cleared her throat. "Be serious." Jothun needed her not to laugh. The first word flashed on the screen. "Afternoon," she said. "Apple." "Aphid." "Apprehend." "As." "After." The words were grouped by letter, but not fully alphabetized. By the G's, she needed a drink of water. He paused the parade of words and handed her a glass. "I know it's a lot. Please be patient." The words continued to flash. "Zig," she said wearily. "Zag." "Zag's it." She sat tall. "What?" "You're done. Now everything is complete. You'll be the first human ever to command bees." "Bees," she said wearily. "There are no bees. That's why I'm a pollinator. There are no bees anywhere." He motioned her over to the box. "Come and look. See what I've done." The box was made of wood, painted black. Jothun used a small key to open a lock on its side, and then he lifted the wood panel facing them, revealing a glass-fronted metal box with many horizontal shelves. As she leaned forward, he handed her a magnifying glass. Taja gasped. Before her, tiny mechanical bugs, shaped like the bees she had seen in pictures, shaped like the bee emblems sewn on the pockets of the pollinators' shirts, shaped like the glass bees she had once seen in a natural history museum, were busily working on something. "Oh, my God," she said, peering through the glass at the top shelf. The tiny bees were fastening wings on another bee. "Oh, my God." "They're bee bots. They make themselves. It's a bee factory, really." "But what do they do? Can they fly?" "Some can, but they've been waiting for you to direct them." Taja picked up the dish holding the bug she had swatted away from her face. Using the magnifying glass, she examined it closely. It didn't look like a real bee, not exactly, but it did fly. "Is that a stinger?" she asked about the point at the tail end of the bee. "Yes, and the stingers work, too. The bees need to be able to protect their queen. Enough stings and one could die from the venom." "Swarm. Sting. Strike." With growing apprehension, she said, "What did you mean by command them?" Jothun gestured at the metal box. "Some of the bees make other bees. That's all they do. Others will collect and redistribute pollen, but they need to be told what to do. They are voice-activated, and now they are programmed to listen to your voice. Only your voice. You'll direct where they go and what they do. "What do you think?" he asked. "Isn't this incredible?" Taja's mind was whirling. What would happen to the tens of thousands of pollinators if they were replaced by bee-bots? What would happen to all the armless children birthed with increasing frequency? What would they do if no one wanted them? If they didn't have an important role in society? Would the government still give them hands or arms? Would they be housed and fed and treasured like they were now? "Taja," Jothan said impatiently, "I've been waiting for a month for this moment. Most of the bee-bots have never flown. Send them into the greenhouse to pollinate the trees. Here, I'll teach you how." They worked through the night. Taja learned to make the bees swarm. She learned to direct them to an area of trees in the greenhouse to collect pollen and then to another area to distribute the pollen. How efficiently, how effectively they worked. With the rising sun came a fresh new round of blossoms. She breathed deeply, missing for a moment the feel of bark, the sway of a limb under her feet, the breeze blowing through her hair. Her team would be waiting for her, wondering where she was, whether something had befallen her. Or maybe they would be snickering, realizing that she had not returned to her bed last night. But they would be waiting. They would not go to the orchard without her. Jothan looked exultant. "Let's tell the world." "But, Jothan, what will the pollinators do if they're not needed?" He remained silent for a long while. Finally, he said, "I did this for you, for us, so we could stay together and you wouldn't have to go away." Taja hung her head. No one had ever loved her as much as Jothan. No one. Yet so much was at stake. The livelihoods of the pollinators, the fate of the deformed, the fate of babies such as herself, the members of her team. Taja held Jothan's hand tightly and gave the command.
I'm Evelyn Evans, and I'm reading Totality by Tony Pisculi. My first total eclipse, Munich International Airport. A fortunate layover on a hectic business trip to Europe. The moon has already carved an enormous black bite from the disk of the sun, leaving a thin white crescent that slowly shrinks as I watch. Just before the crescent vanishes completely, it flares up in four bright dots, Bailey's beads, which wink out one by one in quick succession. The last spills a hot circle of light around the silhouette of the moon before it too sputters out and the corona appears, dancing and flickering like the ghost of the sun. Immediately, the temperature drops and a hush settles on the world. The birds and crickets fall silent, fooled into thinking that day has become night. Totality. I take my safety glasses off, cheap cardboard things with black polymer lenses, and watch the crowd, hundreds, maybe thousands of people, all oriented in the same direction, all wearing glasses, gazing up at the sky. All but two, a man in a well-worn jacket, searching not the sky but the crowd, and a young woman running toward him from the direction of the eclipse. She throws herself at him, and they embrace like lovers, no, like high school sweethearts, passionate but innocent. He picks her up and spins her around, her long blonde hair fanning out behind her. For a brief moment, she's silhouetted against the eclipse. The corona backlights her hair, and she's impossibly beautiful. Then they're whispering and kissing and nuzzling each other, as if reunited after a long absence. I'm embarrassed to witness this intimate moment, but I can't look away. The girl sees me watching and smiles. "Would you take our picture?" she asks. She hands me an old Polaroid camera, the kind with the disposable flash bar across the top. I line the couple up in the viewfinder, and they smile, arms around each other. The flash pops, and the camera whirs. I feel the change before I see it. The air warms slightly, and the birds begin to sing. I look up to see the white, hot crescent of the sun hugging the moon. When I look back, the girl is gone. The man takes the camera from me, the undeveloped photo still hanging from it like a tongue. He tugs it free and writes with a felt-tip pen on the wide bottom border, "Munich, Germany, August 11th, 1999. And below that, 2 minutes, 17 seconds. From his jacket pocket, he produces a stack of some dozen or 16 similar Polaroids wrapped in an aged red rubber band. The band breaks, and the photos tumble to the ground, a patchwork quilt of images of the same couple. In a jungle clearing, the faint wisp of a corona just barely intruding on the frame. Siem Reap, Cambodia, October 24th, 1995, 2 minutes, 10 seconds. Standing on a beach, knee-deep in surf. Baja, California, July 11th, 1991, 6 minutes, 55 seconds. On a bridge lit up from beneath, Portland, Oregon, February 26th, 1979, 1 minute, 58 seconds. I could sort them by the lines on his face and the wear on his jacket, but the girl looks the same in every picture as I saw her a few moments ago, unchanging, forever young. I look up from the face of the boy in the photo to the face of the man he's become. He offers me a sad smile, as if ashamed of his devotion to this intermittent love affair of perhaps 20 minutes total, scattered across many years. He expects pity, but I feel only envy. There's no one waiting for me when I get home to Boston. There's never been anyone waiting for me. And if that's because I never asked anyone to wait or wasn't willing to wait for them, it doesn't ease the sting in this moment. He gently takes the pictures from my hand and disappears into the crowd. In the years since then, I've become an eclipse chaser myself, missing only the events where totality took place over Antarctica or the open ocean. I've seen 6 or more total eclipses, sometimes with a companion, mostly alone. I always look for the lovers, for the telltale flash of someone taking their picture. I've never seen them again, but I know they're there.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.